Good morning, everybody. So what's worrying you these days? Come on, what's worrying you? Think about it for just a minute, you know? You know, we're so used to worry. We're so used to it, we don't even know how to answer the question. Well, everything's worrying me these days. One man said, if you don't have an ulcer, you're just not pulling your weight. We've done it. We've been there. We got the t-shirt. You know, it reminds me of a friend of mine talking, a couple of guys talking together, actually. One of them said, you know, life is just too short for worrying. And he's right about that. The other one said, yeah, I know. That's what worries me. We can always find something to worry about, something to fret over. And some of these things are quite serious, really and truly serious. In some recent polls on the subject of concern, for instance, among parents, a recent poll was taken. Parents of children ages 12 to 17, it revealed that 43% worry about their son or their daughter getting shot at school. Now, I trust that's not in District 9. But nevertheless, nationwide, I mean, what a fear, what a fear. 43%, it's one of their main worries. Drug and alcohol abuse, he goes on, drug and alcohol abuse are more common worries. Nearly 60% of parents think about these possibilities. Even more, 64% fear their teenagers might get AIDS. But the most frequent worry of all, 67% of the parents interviewed stated this as a major worry, is that their teen may not be able to get a good job in the future. Isn't that interesting? Now, the other things I was really worried, I'm thinking, yeah, I'd be worried about that. Oh, yeah, I might be worried about that. Yeah, I might be. And then the last one kind of surprised me. Kind of lets you know what Americans think about, what they consider to be important. Huh? Here's another one. Now, this was a survey done among managers, business managers. And, of course, it's not about Christians per se. It's specifically focused on just the secular business community. And these are managers, remember, supervisors, people who run businesses or own them. What worries them the most, ranked in the top five. Now, that means that what you're going to hear is all of these things ranked in the top five, and they're ranked according to percentages among managers in America. Number one was your own health and fitness. Interesting, 73%. Number two was lack of time for family or leisure pursuits. 49% was worried about that. It was an item of great concern. Third place, I'll put them at 3 and 4. They're both at 43%. Were the children's problems, worrying about children's problems, and also job-related stress. They were tied, children's problems and job-related stress. Here's the next one. At 39%, personal investments, big worry of personal investments, 39%, that was a major source of stress for him. Estate planning was the next one. Estate planning. Now, that's an interesting thing, because that's stuff that's there after you're dead. Now, we're worrying about stuff that happens after we die here, okay? 37%. Then came relationships with children, after that aging, then income level, and finally, marriages at 21%. And it's interesting, the author, and this is from Industry Week, which is a secular publication, and they point out very clearly that relationships with children and marriages come after estate planning in terms of worry. that just kind of blew my mind. We're more worried about what's going to happen to our stuff after we're dead than we are worried about what's happening to our kids now, in terms of our relationships with them. Interesting things. What do you worry about? What focuses your tension, so to speak? And how do you deal with it? Worry can bend your mind. It can bring you into a headspace. And I'm talking now to Christians. Worry can bend your mind and bring you into a situation where you can make decisions on your own that will put you in grave danger. Did you know that? Did you know that worry itself can alter your decision-making and bring you into a situation very often that sets you at cross purposes with God. Worry has a big impact on our discipleship. And sometimes we don't think about that. You know, we don't really evaluate, is my worry factor affecting my actual discipleship to the Lord? Is it affecting my decisions? Is it affecting what I say, where I go, what I do? And is that in turn affecting how I walk with the Lord? Having committed myself to Him, what's the impact of worry on my life? You can make some very bad decisions under the influence of worry. It's almost like a drug. It's almost like a drug. It so affects your feelings and your thinking that you sometimes making a decision under that influence, you wake up later going, why did I do that? Why did I say that? Why was I so worried and I did or said those various things? You know, it's interesting because one of the very lowest points in King David's life, and he's the man we're studying now in 1 Samuel, one of the deepest low points in his life was brought about by a decision he made out of sheer worry. Did you know that? Did you know that in this process of this decision that he made out of sheer worry, he almost lost his life, he almost lost his family, and he almost lost the crown. He almost lost the crown of Israel. He found himself actually fighting, or almost fighting, against the armies of Israel that he used to lead because he made a decision during a time when he was low and worried. And the story is found in 1 Samuel 27. If you haven't already turned there, I invite you to do so. 1 Samuel 27, we're going to look at chapter 27. We're going to skip over into a little bit of chapter 28 and 29 and 30 as well. Just little bits here and there, because the story itself is cohesive, but it's kind of interwoven with another account of what's going on with Saul. It kind of goes back and forth in this particular portion. We're just going to focus on David this morning. Worry. Just think about that. Chapter 27, verse 1. David said to himself, "Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul, then, will despair of searching for me anymore in all the territory of Israel, and I will escape from his hand." So David arose, and he crossed over, and he and his 600 men who were with him and their families, probably a total of close to 1,000 people that were with him, they went to Achish, the son of Maok, the king of Gath, one of the five city-states of the Philistines. Can you imagine this? I mean, you guys, we read this. You know, we're sitting here in church. We're reading this thing, and you're probably not amazed that David did this. But if you know the story of David, you know the kind of man he is. You know what he was called to do. You remember his life. It's amazing that after serving Israel, after serving God, after being such a courageous warrior, now at a low moment, he would make a decision literally to defect to the Philistines. I mean, if you'd have told him that he would ever do that, he would say, never. I would never do that. I kill Philistines. That's my job. I'm an anti-Philistine guy. I would never go to the Philistines. You talked to David a year before, 2 years before, maybe 3 years before, when he was still one of the main commanders in the Israeli army. You talk to him then, you say, "David, you know, there's going to come a time when your decision-making is going to be so bent by the worries that have set upon you that you'll make a decision in which you will defect from the armies of Israel and become a mercenary pirate in the armies of the Philistines." Oh, David would say, "Never. I'd never do that." But that's exactly what he did. He's in his late 20s. And for the last 16 months of this period of time in his life, when he was running for his life from Saul, for the last 16 months, he spent his life and the lives of those who were with him, about 1,000 people in all, he spent his life as essentially a pirate and a mercenary for the Philistines. It's not quite as bad as it looks, but it is almost as bad as it looks. Look what happens here. David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each with his household, And David had his two wives with him, Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. I wonder what Abigail was thinking. And when she married him, remember the story? She married him because her husband was dead, and he, before he died, had kind of been a jerk. Not kind of, he was a jerk. His name actually meant kind of jerk in Hebrew. And he was that way. She married David. She's thinking, I've got it made in the shade. I have married a godly man. This is wonderful. Got rid of the bozo, married a godly man. And now this godly man is making a decision that puts her in Gath, the hometown of Goliath, in the enemy camp. You never know, do you, where life's going to lead you. You make a decision now, and you connect with other people, and you never know what's going to happen down the line. She went with David, and it must have been an adventure being married to David. Man, would not have been boring. Can you imagine all 1,000 of these people coming into town, walking into town? They were walking, probably not riding, and with the clink, clink of the armor and the family and the kids and the stuff and everything, and the dust and everything. Come into Gath. The Philistines are looking at them going, these are Hebrews. I think I've seen that guy's picture on Time Magazine's cover. That's David. And the whole scene of coming in to this particular situation, what a weird situation to be in. And David's gone, I think it's the only thing I can do. Saul's going to kill me. It's the only thing I can do. So what he does is he lives with Achish there. And finally, after a period of time, he says, look, it's not right for me to be living here. I got 1,000 people. They probably outnumbered the Gathites. Okay. So he says, you just tell me where you want me to go, and I'll go there. And Achish says, take this little town called Ziklag. Go to Ziklag and take that town. Let it be your domain over there. I'll let you rule that little town, and you can serve me. You can be part of my army, and you'll be safe. Because Achish had heard that David was on the outs with Saul, and that Saul tried to kill David twice with his army, and before that, several times, personally. And so he figured, well, I'm safe with David. David is an enemy of Saul. I'll give David this little city called Ziklag. And so David does that. He goes over and he takes Ziklag. Verse 6, Achish gave him Ziklag that day, and Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. The number of the days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. And David and his men went up and raided the Jeshurites, the Gerzites, the Amalekites, and whatever other ites might have been around, I suppose. And they were in the inhabitants of the land from ancient times. These are Canaanite nations that he is raiding. Now notice this and watch what he does. A very interesting little ploy he puts to work. First of all, he said he gets out of sight of Achish. He gets where Achish can't find him. Okay, they had no satellites to watch people in those days, right? So he's over quite a ways away from Achish, 25, 30 miles away at little Ziklag, and he starts raiding. He is a warrior. He is a warrior king. And he starts to make war on these other tribes that were enemies, not of the Philistines, but enemies of Israel. They were enemies of Israel. So he still fights Israel's battles, but he's letting Achish think he's serving the Philistines. Very interesting little scene. David attacked the land, did not leave a man or a woman alive. And he took away the sheep and the cattle and the donkey and the camels and the clothing. And he returned and he came to Achish. And Achish said, where have you been making raids? And David said, oh, against the Negev of Judah and against the Negev of the Jerahmeelites and against the Negev of the Kenites. He tells him he's attacking Judah. He says, I'm fighting the Israelites. Achish is going, good, very good. That's a good Philistine warfare thing to do. Meanwhile, David goes right back and does the same thing again. He attacks what are really allies of the Philistines and enemies of Israel, comes back to Achish, brings the spoil, and he's making quite a name for himself. Verse 12, so Achish believed David, saying, he has surely made himself odious among the people of Israel, therefore he will become my servant forever. Now, let me mention 3 things by way of observation as we get into this. And I am interpreting this as a bad decision on David's part. And you're going to see why as we go through it. Even though God doesn't specifically, audibly get on David's case for this, you're going to see as we go through this, and I hope you agree with me, that it is a bad decision on David's part that he does this thing. Let me make 3 observations to help us shape what we're learning in the passage. Because you read this and you go, what can we learn from this? Let's start by making some observations. First of all, this is a decision that David made based on fear rather than on faith. Please note that. It's a decision based on fear rather than on faith. He is not saying, how can I trust God in this situation? What he's saying is, I'm in trouble, I got to fix this situation, and I'm really not even asking God. And I don't blame him for being afraid. Saul tried to kill him five times. I've had two threats on my life since I've been a pastor, and that's not too bad. Two threats on my life since I've been a pastor in over a period of 20 years. And I know pastors whose lives are threatened every year, sometimes several times a year, okay? So that's not a terrible record, you know, two times. But I'll tell you, it gave me a pretty weird feeling to know that somebody wanted to kill me and that they were out there. I had a guy come after me with a baseball bat one time. I'll tell you that story another time. Anyway, it's frightening to know somebody wants to kill you. They hate you bad enough to kill you. To have them, to barely miss being killed, because, like, you know, David would duck and spears would fly over his head, you know, five times this happened. That can get to your nerves. Then he goes away and lives in the wilderness. Saul comes after him twice with an army, 3,000 guys coming out to kill David. This can wear on a guy. I don't blame him for being afraid, but notice he makes the decision out of fear rather than out of faith. That brings us to the next observation I want you to take note of, and that is he makes the decision only with human wisdom rather than divine guidance. He does not ask God whether to do this. And you say, well, how do you know he doesn't ask God? How do you know he didn't ask God whether he should do this? Well, first of all, it doesn't say that he did. And usually it will tell you if David is inquiring. In fact, in the story, he does. A little later, he inquires of the Lord. But there's a real interesting little key in verse 1 that tells us. David said to himself, I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. Did David ask God about that? If David is saying this to himself, Saul's going to kill me, did David ask God? Do you know what God told David early on in his life, that he would be the king? Has he been king yet? No. God had told David over and over again, you're going to be there, you're going to be okay, you're going to live through this, you're going to be the king. But David was so low, he wasn't listening to God, and he was not inquiring. This was a decision, note please, made on human wisdom rather than with divine guidance. It seemed logical to David at the time. It was weird, and I bet you later in his life he looked back on it and said, man, I can't believe I did that. Do you ever make a decision like that? Based on fear instead of faith? Made of human wisdom instead of divine guidance. When David had access to divine guidance, Abiathar the priest was there, the ephod was there. He uses them later to find out what God wants. He makes the decision on his own. Snap decision, I got to believe. It was a snap decision. Made at a low moment out of fear. Notice this final observation. It's a decision born of worry rather than rebellion. Now, it's a slightly different contrast, so please take note of it. It's a decision born of worry, not of rebellion. Now, what I'm trying to say is this. David was worried and it bent his mind and he made a bad decision, but it's not the same as if he were saying, I've had it with God and I'm going into rebellion against God. This is one of those types of decisions, and this is what I want to focus on in terms of decision making and in terms of worry. It's one of those decisions that is a bad decision made for the wrong reasons at a bad time, but it is not a decision that makes us think that David doesn't love God. He does love God. He wants to serve God, but he's not thinking faithfully. This is not rebellion, and it is not technically disobedience against God's word. It isn't really technically disobedience against God's word. And you know why? Because David didn't kill any Israelites. He retained his identity. What he did was not good. He did some bad things at this time. We'll talk about them in a minute. But I want you to notice, he retained his identity as the king of Israel. He was still doing kingly stuff. He was fighting the enemies of Israel. He was just doing it in a sneaky, underhanded, lying, brutal way. Which is what happens to us when we start thinking for ourselves instead of asking God what to do. We get sneaky, manipulative, underhanded, and brutal. Because we're going to win. See? Well, that's what he did. Now notice, in my opinion, and, you know, maybe you think I'm crazy, but this is one of my favorite stories in the whole Bible. Yeah, well, you've been reading the Bible too long, son. You need to, you know. Honest it is. You know why? Because I see God's people, myself included, making decisions like this very often. And I'm so happy to see someone like David make this kind of a decision. And you know what else I'm happy to see? God bails him out of it. But before we get to that, Let me mention the three things. We'll kind of trace out the story. We'll see the three things that happen as a result of this bad decision. The first one you already saw. It's basically ethically questionable behavior came out of this bad decision. You make a decision, not with God's guidance, but on your own wisdom, out of fear. You still love the Lord, but you're not thinking about the Lord, and you're not asking Him what to do. And what happens is you get into ethically questionable issues, don't you? First of all, just making friends with the Philistines was ethically questionable. Secondly, he has to lie in order to maintain his identity there, which is, to say the least, ethically questionable. If you had asked him about it at the time, he'd have said, "I'm only lying to a Philistine." And that doesn't count. It's like lying to a cockroach. He'd have probably said that. You say, well, that's no excuse. Yes and no. Would you have lied to the Nazis to save your family? I would have. And I will go on record. You can argue with me about whether it would have been the right thing to do, but I know I would have done it. I know for a fact I would have done it. Okay, so now factor that in a little bit to what David is doing here. Nevertheless, he has to live dishonestly in order to make this happen. You see how this kind of gets into this murky stuff? You make bad decisions like this, you get into these murky decisions. And they put you in positions like this. And notice that he killed everybody in these villages. Did anybody catch that? It is said twice. He killed all the adults in the villages, not just the soldiers. And I want to emphasize that. I am not going to gloss that over. What he's doing is he's invoking a law in Israel against Canaanite nations. See, these are Canaanite nations, and there's no doubt these nations would have destroyed Israel in precisely the same manner, I might add. But he's basically declaring holy war on these nations. That's what a holy war was about. They killed everybody. These were Canaanite people that God had said, "I want them destroyed out of that land." That's another issue. David was using that, but for his personal reasons. And that is, again, ethically unconscionable. Yes, he's a warrior. Yes, he's a soldier. But in order to keep his secret, he has to be more brutal than he had a right to be. Now, it's interesting that when David, his great passion in his life, later in his life, was to build the temple. That's what he really wanted to do. And do you remember when God told him he couldn't build the temple? Do you remember the reason he gave him? He said, "No, David, you cannot build a temple because you are what? A man of bloodshed." A man of bloodshed. I've made the comment on several occasions, David was not a softy. David was more brutal than we would like to know, because he was a warrior. He was a king and a warrior, and he lived at a time when his main job was to physically protect the nation of Israel against enemies that wanted to destroy it at all costs. And because he was that kind of a warrior, he has a warrior's sins. He has a warrior's sins. And I'm not making excuses for him, and he has to stand before God. But we got to, is David kind of coming off the flannel board for you these days? I hope so. Is he kind of coming out of church? Because he wouldn't have made a good Christian churchman in these respects. He made a good warrior at the time God needed a warrior. And he walked with God. Yes, he did walk with God, but he was not perfect, and God did rebuke him and severely chastised him for his sins. Now, what happened here? David made a decision that got himself into a position where he did morally questionable things, to say the least. And he lived that way for 16 months. But there's another thing that happens when you do this. When you make a decision based on human wisdom and you start making friends with the enemy to save your skin, it puts you in another situation as well. Look at chapter 28, verses 1 and 2. It came about in those days that the Philistines gathered their army, their armed camps for war, to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, "Look, David, know assuredly that you will go with me into the camp, you and your men." And David said to Achish, okay. What could he say? He couldn't say, "I won't fight with you." He was stuck. And Achish is gathering up to go to war against Israel. And David says, okay, well, you'll know what your servant can do. Isn't that an interesting way to put it? Well, you'll see what I can do. I wonder what would have happened if David had actually gotten involved in that battle. So Achish said to David, "Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life." Now here's David, the enemy of the Philistines, the king of Israel, the man who's protecting Israel. He finds himself as the bodyguard, wearing a patch on his shoulder that says he's working for Achish, the Adolf Hitler of the Philistines, okay? What is wrong with this picture? Go over, just skip over the story about Saul and go to chapter 29. The Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek while the Israelites were camping by the spring, which is at Jezreel. So this is the, by the way, this is the Jezreel Valley, which is the Armageddon Valley, one of the famous battlefields in all of human history. And that's where this battle took place. The Gilboa Mountains come right down to the kind of the nape of the neck of the Jezreel Valley, which is the Valley of Armageddon, where the Jezreel meets the Jordan Valley. The Gilboa Mountains descend into that place. That's where this battle took place. Now they're massing their troops, and David's part of the group. You imagine him and his guys, they're saying, "David, are we going up there to fight on the side of the Philistines? Hello, hello." Do you remember what the Philistines, you can hear the grumbling, and David's going, I know, but I'm stuck. I mean, what can I do? If I back out of this battle, all those Philistines at Aphek are gonna come down here and make us smudges on the dirt here. You think we're afraid of Saul. You've seen what Philistines do. I'm stuck. So he gets with his guys and they go up there and they come riding around over through the pass and around down through the valley past the Carmel Mountain range, and the dust is rising and the tents are out there and all the soldiers, and they're looking at him. Here comes David and his 600, and the Philistine soldiers are looking at him. Now there's more Philistines than just Achish now. There's four other kings, and they're all out there with all their armies, and these four other kings get word. Did you hear that? Did you hear it? This new guy, Achish, made friends with David. David, you mean David, the one that they used to sing the song about how many Philistines he killed? Yeah, that's the one. Achish made friends with him. He works for Achish. He's got one of Achish's uniforms on. He's got all of his guys there. Oh, they didn't like this at all. They came to Achish and they said, you can't do this. You cannot do this. We do not want this guy on the team. Get him out of here. If we get involved in this battle and he turns on us, we're in deep weeds. That's a very free translation, but that's basically what they're saying. Achish goes to David and he says, "David, you know I love you, buddy. But these guys, the lords of the Philistines, they don't like you. They don't trust you. Now, you've been honest with me." Little did Achish know. Huh? Achish says, "I know you've been really straight with me and I know you're walking with God." And David must have been thinking, you know, and his guys behind him going, "Yeah, right. But David, you're going to have to go back to Ziklag." Praise God. Well, David puts up a little fight. He says, "What have I done that you don't like me anymore? Blah, 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 yada, yada, yada." But he's really glad to get out of there. And all of his guys and him, they turn around and go back down to Ziklag. And we'll pick that up in just a minute. But here's what I want to point out. When you make decisions like this, you find yourselves in moral dilemmas where you're on the wrong side. And you look around and you go, "Oh, what am I doing here? How did I find myself here? How am I in this group?" I remember one time when I was a new Christian, and I did love the Lord, but I hung around with a group that didn't. And we were into the party scene, and we were kind of little hard guys, you know. We thought we were something tough. And we came into a little coffee shop that was a Christian coffee shop. Now, that was when Christian coffee shops were a brand new phenomenon. Nobody knew what they were. But a bunch of Jesus people had come up and started a coffee shop in Santa Cruz, my hometown. And we went in there, me and my buddies, and they started preaching in the coffee shop. And I knew I'd given my life to the Lord in the previous year. And I all of a sudden found myself on the wrong side of the fence, and it was a very weird feeling. I felt like David might have felt here. It was a strange phenomenon. It was one of the first times I actually felt so different as a believer in a situation like this. And I'd been compromising. And because I'd been compromising, I was kind of with the Philistines. I don't mean that, you know, I mean, actually two or three of those guys got saved over the next few years, and it was a good thing. But at the moment, this is the feeling I had. It was like, what am I doing here? Did that ever happen to you? Find yourself on the wrong side? You know what? When that happens, you can trace those decisions back. Just trace them back. Made a decision about a month ago, 2 months ago, a year ago, 10 years ago. that now has put you in a spot where you're going, wait a minute, but I belong on that side, and here I am on this side, and how come I got all these mixed feelings? Bad decision. Bad decision. Maybe made at a time when temptation or worry were bending your mind, put you on the wrong team. You decided to join the wrong team. Moral dilemma. So you've got dishonesty that happens when you make bad decisions, and you've got dilemma that occurs when you make bad decisions. Jot down 2 Corinthians 6:14. 2 Corinthians 6:14 says, do not be bound together with unbelievers, because what does light have in common with darkness, and so on. 2 Corinthians 6:14. We need to be careful where we declare our loyalties as believers. Dilemma will occur. And here's the third thing that takes place, and it's in chapter 30 of 1 Samuel. The results of bad decisions like this are very painful. They're unpleasant. Dishonesty happens, dilemma occurs in your life, and finally discipline. And I take the taking of Ziklag as a discipline against David. While David was up marching with the Philistines, probably wondering what in the world he was going to do, and in my opinion, probably figuring he was going to turn on him in the middle of the battle. I must assume he was planning to do that. While he was up there, he left undefended Abigail, Ahinoam, and all the rest of the wives and families of his 600 guys. They probably had only a skeleton crew of soldiers left there to keep a watch over this city, Ziklag. While they were gone, the hated Amalekites, that Saul, by the way, was supposed to have completely wiped out but apparently didn't do the job, came against David in huge numbers, came against Ziklag, and they burned it and they kidnapped everybody. You say, well, why didn't they kill everybody? Because they were going to sell them as slaves, which in those days was probably worse than dying for a Hebrew. While David was up with the Philistines, the Amalekites come against Ziklag, and they completely destroyed the city. They burned it to the ground, and they stole, kidnapped his family, his kids, all of the everybody else's family, so that when David and his men come back after an 80-mile march on foot, in the late spring, which is when they made war, okay, it would have been hot. And they're tired, and they're coming back thinking, man, I'll be glad to get home, get a glass of iced tea. Just sit down on the couch and rest. That's what they're thinking. They come back, and they come around the corner, and there's Ziklag, and it's just smoking. It's just a big black pile on the ground with smoke coming up, and there is nobody there. And you can imagine that scene as they come into this rubble that was once their city, and they're looking, picking through the rubble. What are they looking for? Bodies. They're looking for bodies of their families. This is a horrible scene. And David, right along with them, they're sweat-soaked, they're dirty, they're dusty, they're tired, they're hungry, they're exhausted, and they come back to this thing that was once their home, and it's destroyed. And they wail. It says they wailed until they were exhausted from crying. And these are tough guys. These are tough men. They came back, and they were just absolutely crushed. Verse 4, David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength left in them to weep. These tough warriors. And David must have at this point begun to wonder, because you can tell by what he does in verse 6. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. Can you believe this? Here's David thinking, I have lost it all. These guys are going to kill me right here because my decision has cost them their families. They were embittered, each one, because of his sons and his daughters. Now that last line in verse 6, that is an amazing line. But David strengthened himself in the Lord. Now this is the first indicator we have of David actually relying on God, coming to God, doing anything with the Lord with regard to these things. He strengthened himself in the Lord. And he said to Abiathar the priest, who traveled with him, get me the ephod. Now, this was the way they understood God's will in those days. It was part of the old covenant. He had a priest, a real priest, who had the ephod. That was the garment the priest wore. It probably had the Urim and the Thummim in it, the little stones that they would use. And God would use them providentially to give them direction. And so he asked the Lord, what shall I do? Shall I go after the Amalekites? It's the first time that the Lord is really consulted here. And the Lord says, yeah, go after him. David goes after him with his exhausted 600 guys. They get about halfway to where the Amalekites might be. They don't know where they are. They're just kind of following the trail. Get halfway there. 200 guys are so tired they cannot go on, so David leaves them behind with all the equipment, takes his foot soldiers with him with just their weaponry, finds an Egyptian servant that was left for dead by the Amalekites, nurses him back to life and says, who are you? What you do? Well, I work for the Amalekites and we raided Ziklag. And David goes, oh, very nice. Here, have something to eat. Now, tell me where these guys are. Will you take me down where you think they're camping? You bet I will, baby. But if you'll take care of me, I'll take care of you. So the Egyptian says, this way. David and his guys surprise the Amalekites, completely destroy them, except for 400 guys who escape on camels. And David gets everybody back alive. Can you believe that? It's an amazing miracle. Brings all the families back to the guys. And becomes, once again, the David he was meant to be. All this is taking place at the same time of the Battle of Gilboa, which is the battle that Saul was killed in. These two battles are taking place at the same time. Saul is up north in the battle David would have been in. But David is down south in Ziklag, capturing the Amalekites or killing the Amalekites and recapturing Ziklag and his family back. It's an interesting, just a little sidelight, how gracious God is. He bailed David out. He bailed him out majorly. Up there with the Philistines, something came up. David didn't have to fight. He must have been just going, whew. And then when he got down there at Ziklag, he had to have been thinking, Lord, I'm sorry I ever made the decision to come to the Philistines. And the Lord's thinking, yeah, you are sorry in more ways than one on this topic, David. But I will still bless you. You still belong to me. And in God's grace, he gives him back his families, and he gives him back all of his possessions. David's able to make gifts to the other leaders from what he gets from the Amalekites. God just plain bails him out. That just warms my heart. Because you know what? I make bad decisions sometimes. I find myself in situations, I can't believe I'm here. Can't believe I'm doing this or saying that. I can't believe I did that. And I rely on the grace of God. And you can rely on the grace of God, too. If you really belong to Him, trust the Lord. Now, I want to close with just a couple of thoughts, and we'll be done. Two practical truths for pressured Christians, huh? The time to strengthen, here's the first one. The time to strengthen yourself in the Lord is when the worry first begins. Now, please take note of that. David did strengthen himself in the Lord. He started praying. He started probably worshiping again. He probably got out some of his old psalms he had already written back when things were hard, you know, and he got his life back with the Lord, strengthened himself in the Lord. But let me point something out. The time to do that is not after Ziklag is burned. I mean, it's never too late to do that. But the time to do it is when the worry first begins. When worry starts to settle in and dominate your feelings and dominate your thinking, that's the time to strengthen yourself in the Lord. Here's what we do. We say, no, that's the time to solve the problem in the flesh. But what I'm suggesting is, if you got something that's worrying you that much, the key to dealing with it is to strengthen yourself in the Lord when the worry first starts. Because I'll tell you something, the worry becomes more of an enemy than the thing you're worried about. The thing you're worried about, God can probably handle. Your worry is destroying your faith and your joy and your peace. That ought to be seen as the enemy, the worry itself. May I give you a piece of advice, and myself too, because I do this. I worry a lot. Let's do something with our worry. Let's turn it around and make it something good. When worry happens, let's let it drive us to two things: devotion, strengthening ourselves in the Lord, and decision making. And that'll bring us to the second aspect of what we're learning here. But the worry may indicate that you got to make a decision, fine. But let it bring you to devotion first. Let it drive you to your knees first. Don't go solve your problem, then come back to God. Come to God first and see how He wants to solve the problem. Let worry be an alarm, like a smoke alarm in your house. It says, whoa, something might be wrong, and then go to God with it. That's a good way to deal with it. Much better than, you know, what we usually do. You know, one time, years ago, Barb and I were in Sacramento. It was very cold, and it was very foggy. And, you know, the Thule fog, like here. Freezing cold outside, getting foggier and foggier. It's nighttime. We're trying to make it from one end of Sacto to the other. And we get two-thirds of the way there. It is so pea soup that I'm scared to death. We're both tense. We're leaning forward, looking out the windshield. I'm leaning over the wheel. And And we kept driving and driving. I got the windshields, whoosh, 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 whoosh. Can barely see 3 feet in front of me. Finally get to the place where we're going, and I get out of the car, and I was amazed how well I could see. I got out of the, I thought, oh, it looks much better out here. I looked inside. It was still very foggy. Do you know what we had done? Our own worry had generated so much moisture on the inside of the car that I thought it was foggy outside. It was foggy inside. You know what, you guys? That's us. That's us when we're worrying so much we're not walking with God anymore. We're foggy on the inside. It's on the inside. The Lord's out there going, it's not as foggy as you think it is. I am here. And we're going, oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. I can't trust God anymore. The worry itself can become the enemy. Let it become an alarm to drive you to the Lord instead of something that drives you away from Him and drives you into bad decisions. And here's the second thing we learn, something to be reminded of. The time to inquire of the Lord, you know what's coming. The time to inquire of the Lord is before you make the decision. Hello? See, what we do is, we see the problem, we start worrying, we fix it, then we go to God and say, I hope you'll bless this fix I put on this thing. The time to inquire of God is before you make a major decision, not after. Of course, after is still fine, better late than never, but the time to really do it is to say, Lord, I got this worry, I got a concern, I may need to make a decision, I may need to go in a new direction, would you please, I'm going to lay it before you, I'm going to wait for an answer. I'm not going to go off in the flesh trying to fix it on my own. The time to inquire of the Lord is before we make the decision. And you know what? There are two types of decisions we make that are to do with life, aspects of life here on earth, that I have found as a pastor. I've watched folks through the years that we make the decision, then ask God to bless it. Two types. One having to do with romance. Romance. Now, some of you shouldn't nod too heavily. But romance is something that often we do at the gut level. We say, oh, well, I feel attracted to so-and-so, and I'm going to go, you know. And we don't say, Lord, is this the right thing to do before I get too attracted? Is this someone that I believe is walking with you? We don't ask those kind of questions. May I encourage you in the area, if you're not married, and if you are married, your decision's made, okay? So we'll leave you alone. But if you're not married and you're saying to yourself, oh, you know, I'm going to make a decision about romance. Don't make that decision based on guts. You go to God. You let Him confirm it. Another area we do this is money. We make our decisions about money and business and livelihood and investments. A lot of times we make them based on worldly wisdom, worldly knowledge, what feels good to us at the time, what we want, how high our buying temperature is, huh? When we're talking to the salesman, and then bingo, we end up buying something, we have terminal buyer's remorse, we go back and ask God to give us some money to pay for the thing we bought, or whatever. Be careful on that one too. Money and romance are the two areas that people tend to make decisions based on emotions instead of going to God and asking for wisdom. The time to inquire of the Lord, Christian friend, the time to inquire of the Lord is before you make the decision. If David had inquired of the Lord, if David had strengthened himself in the Lord, basically done the things that he did after Ziklag was burned, if he'd have done them before, back in chapter 27, he'd have saved himself a lot of grief. But we wouldn't have such a great story, would we? Let's bow our heads. Take a moment and lift up the things that you have in your mind right now, the worries, and offer them over to the Lord. Worry is in and of itself not a sin. That is, it is not the same kind of sin as many others described in the Bible. But it can lead us to sin. It can bend our minds and make us say and do things that later we really regret. It can drive us into dishonesty in order to fix our problem, into dilemma, where we find ourselves on the wrong side of the fence. And finally, discipline. There can be some very real loss in our lives. David lost Ziklag. That discipline hurt him desperately. We can save ourselves these things by dealing with worry when it first shows its head. by seeing it as an alarm and letting it drive us to the Lord, strengthening ourselves in the Lord, and then inquiring of Him before we make our decisions. Take a moment to just release that worry or those worries to Him. And if you're somewhere in the process, down the line, it's never too late to inquire of the Lord. It's never too late to say, Lord, how can I straighten this out? And please bail me out. Amazingly, in His grace, He does that. Father, we lift our lives up to You. We know, Lord, that discipleship is a daily thing. And I myself, along with probably every adult in this place, I rue the day that I made some of the decisions and said some of the things I've said. And mine are on tape. Lord, please bail us out of some of these things and let us come before You with humility. And please help us to straighten out some of the bad decisions we've made. And Father, I'd also lift up all of us as we make more decisions in our lives, that we would come before You before we try and make our own way. Thank You for David's life and for the earthiness of his spirituality. He was a man of his age, a man of his day, and we would not imitate David's sins in any way, shape, or form, but we thank You for the gracious way in which You dealt with him, and we ask that You would deal with us in our day, in our age, in that same gracious way, that we might serve You and love You with full hearts. In Jesus' name, amen.